some of my colleagues have this really interesting question that they've been asking for the past few months. Can it save us? Now, specifically, they are talking about technology. This is the team that put together the Codebreaker podcast, and you'll hear from them later in the show. But the idea of being saved, rescued from modern predicaments, is popping up a lot lately. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. Think about this with me. We've heard people say they voted for Donald Trump because he promised to save certain kinds of jobs. Today, we're going to meet a wellness entrepreneur who is selling people a way of eating that might rescue them from their own bad habits. Talk about movies where awards prestige might save them at the box office. And finally, learn from the Codebreaker team about tech that might save the climate. Come share your thoughts with us at marketplace.org, on Facebook, or on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. We are starting off the show, as we do most weeks, with our long and short segment. We borrow some terms from the world of finance. Long as in betting on something, short as in betting against it. And we apply it to the news. This week, we've got Jillian White, Senior Associate Editor at The Atlantic, and Marketplace's own Andy Euler. Welcome back to both of you.
Thanks for having me.
Good to be here.
All right, Jillian, lead us off. You're batting first. Give us your long.
My long is Trump tweets. I am long on Donald Trump tweeting, and I'm also long on Donald Trump's tweets impacting companies, the market, general sentiment. I know a lot of people think that after inauguration, he is going to slow down. I do not necessarily think that's true. I think he will probably find some sort of workaround, even if it's hiring a staffer to stand next to him at all times and dictate his tweets to them.
I mean, what does this do to a company? I mean, we've seen it, you know, with Boeing and others. But, like, is there any way, if you run a corporation, to insure yourself from the Trump tweet crash or the Trump tweet bounce?
I don't think so. I think the only way is to kind of stay off of his radar. And that's part of the reason that I'm long on this. I feel like if you find yourself on Donald Trump's Twitter radar and the president of the United States says something about you, good or bad, it's really hard for that not to have some sort of impact. And social media really, really amplifies that reach.
But social media as public policy, I've been talking to a bunch of folks about this. You can delete a tweet. But you can't delete something if you're the president of the United States because is that policy? Is that tell me what's going on here.
Right. I mean, we're in this nebulous gray area, right, where that becomes kind of a matter of historical record. You can't really just delete that as if you were a private citizen
exactly
and you no longer want it out there. So it just kind of is there. And the president has said whatever it is. And that's reached however many millions of people. So it's a confusing time.
We are in seriously uncharted territory. Okay, Andy, your long maybe could go together, although he hasn't really started using these. Give us your long.
Oh, come on. I'm long on emojis, but I'm kind of long on emojis as a universal language. We read about a company in London looking for an emoji translator because some emoji just don't translate across different languages. I think this is fascinating. Emojis are basically the fastest growing language, if you think about it. And it's a really easy way for us to communicate emotion, for us to communicate, you know, online things that we're thinking about. It just translates really well, right?
Embarrassed smile one a lot. I don't know what it's for, but I assume that it is kind of a humiliated, like, smile.
Well, exactly. And like me and the shruggy, like I should probably just have that all of the time. I say stupid things all the time. You guys listen to them all the time. I think it makes a whole lot of sense. And when a business takes the step to hire somebody to translate these, it's not all that goofy. It's not just kind of a silly thing that's going on here. It's not something your kids are using on your phone. This is real.
I communicate about 50% in emoji only text.
There it is.
Wow. I mean, I will say that I think the thing that has pushed it over for me is that my 70-year-old mother is using emojis. And, you know, that means it has gone beyond the under 40 generation. Jillian, we're going to stay on the other side of the pond for your short.
Yes, I am short the euro, though kind of temporarily. So this week,
I mean, that's
as
not the most courageous you're short.
You're shorting a short.
I'm so brave. But I mean, this is the lowest level it's been at since 2003. And I think the timing is kind of fortuitous because we're entering that crazy holiday period where trading is a bit thin. Mm-hmm. So it means that even though this is probably kind of a temporary low, it might go a little lower. So I'm going to go ahead with my very courageous short. Thanks, guys. And I'm going to say that I'm short the euro. And maybe if I could book a trip overseas in the next 2 weeks, I might do that.
I'm totally going to Europe in about a month. So this is awesome.
Oh, Andy.
Oh, come on. I'm not bragging, y'all.
That is, in fact, exactly what you're doing.
Sure. And that's what that looks
and
like.
And adding a global currency trade on the top of your
brag. This is me shrugging, kind of.
In emoji style. Nice, right. Dude. All right. Why don't you tell us your short? And you're going to have to, spell it out for me because
okay.
I don't care about this at all.
So
go ahead.
Sure. Fair enough. That's a great, thank you for that mm-hmm. glowing intro. That's very nice. I am short Los Angeles having two NFL football teams. And I'm short this because, the Rams just got back here from St. Louis. They were a team here for a long time. Now there's talk of either the San Diego Chargers coming to Los Angeles because their contract on their stadium is up, or even the Oakland Raiders, who used to be in Los Angeles in the 80s and 70s yep. and 80s under Al Davis. They were in Los Angeles. They're talking about coming here as well. They're also kind of talking about going to Las Vegas. I just don't think, given sort of the support that the Rams have in the first year back, I don't think Los Angeles, even though it's the second largest media market, I don't think it's set up to support two football teams anymore. They're a basketball town. They have tons of college football. I just don't think the NFL as a product, I mean, they moved a lot of their production here, and that was part of the move for the Rams to come back, is that NFL Films is now here. They have a lot of production here, but I just don't think it's a two football team town.
Yeah, I'm down in the two basketball team town, sure. A two baseball team town, but football doesn't do it for me, man.
Right.
You know, as a New York girl, I'm going to disagree with this. I
okay.
love having two of everything. I think that who you root for in a two-team town really says a lot about who you are. You know, for instance,
true.
If you root for the Yankees over the Mets, you enjoy success and winning and excellence. So, I mean,
and you're
the
a bad
empire
person.
Over the Rebels.
Right. I mean, I'm a Dallas Cowboys fan. I can't say anything. The Yankees, what are the Yankees of football?
All right. Marketplace's Andy Euler, The Atlantic's Jillian White. Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Thanks, Lizzie.
We still don't know how President-elect Trump will handle his potential business conflicts. Trump had promised to tell the world his plans last week, but he canceled a press conference about it. For now, a lot of questions remain. Marketplace's Mark Garrison has been covering this for several weeks, and he joins us now to bring us up to speed. Hi, Mark.
Hey, Lizzie.
So there were a lot of developments in the sort of Trump transition over the past week that people might have missed. Bring us up to speed. Where are we now?
So on Twitter, which is the level of detail he's given on many of these questions, he says he's working on leaving his business. His adult sons, Eric and Donald Jr., will manage along with an executive team. He also tweeted, quote, no new deals will be done during his presidency.
What does no new deals mean? I mean, that doesn't really say very much. How are we supposed to digest that?
Well, it can mean a lot of things, or it can mean not that much at all. That's why it's kind of a very effective tweet, because it seems to say something to supporters and something else to other people. And the other thing about new deals, so let's say that means he doesn't make any new business arrangements, licensing deals or something like that. There's plenty of potential problems with the old deals, the things that are on the table now. They're complicated, sometimes kind of murky to figure out what's going on. You know, he's got licensing deals for skyscrapers in the Philippines, India, Turkey. Sometimes the business partners he has or the people that have licensed his name have controversial connections with some mm-hmm. of the government. So all of these things are issues where even without having any new deals, if there's still a problem with some of the existing deals.
We talked on this show before with an election lawyer about sort of
the law governing conflicts and the perception governing conflicts of interest and how those are kind of different things. You've been talking to ethics experts as this unfolds. What do they say he still needs to do?
Well, there are a lot of possibilities. I mean, his assets could be moved into a blind trust so that when he makes decisions, he wouldn't necessarily know the direct impact on his fortune. And a proposal that's getting a lot of bipartisan attention is that what he actually needs to do is sell all of his stakes in the business. So that's from Richard Painter, who was the chief ethics lawyer for President George W. Bush. He and his Obama administration counterpart, Norman Eisen, came up with this plan. It is complicated to sell all of his assets because it's not just a portfolio of stocks, for example. There are licensing deals and hotels, real estate and such. And so Trump aides have said, hey, why are you guys bothering us about this and pressuring us? We're going to figure something out. It's just complex. It takes some time. But I asked Painter about this, and he's not buying it.
It's going to take some time to sell these businesses, but he could solve this problem right now by saying he's going to sell them. There are a range of different options to be explored, and I'm not insisting on seeing a plan right now that shows exactly who it's going to be sold to. What I want to hear for the president-elect is a commitment that he's going to sell.
And so far, Trump hasn't been clear about saying that he will sell. He's only said that, or hinted at least, that he would step back from business operations, day-to-day management, that kind of thing. But that can still be a problem if he is in a position to make decisions as president that could impact his businesses and impact his wealth. And also, if the kids manage and own the businesses, that could be okay ethically, but there needs to be a real firewall that basically says, okay, the children are not allowed to talk about business with anybody in the administration.
Well, and they've been sitting in on a number of transition meetings, which makes all of this murkier. That is the president-elect, but there are also some potential other conflicts of interest in this administration, notably Rex Tillerson, the potential nominee for Secretary of State, ExxonMobil CEO. What do we have to untangle there?
So again, subject to Senate confirmation, that is another wealthy business leader that's on the Trump administration list for the cabinet. Now, his holdings are less complicated than Trump. It's mostly ExxonMobil stock, somewhere around $200 million of it. It's easier to sell stock and then put it into a blind trust or conflict-free assets. There are ways to deal with that. We've had wealthy executives with big stock holdings before who have entered government. It can be done. And so that's an issue. It could be dealt with. We'll see how that goes. But even if you deal with all that, there's still the question of his closeness to the energy sector. He's essentially been the Secretary of State for ExxonMobil, going around the world, making
certainly
deals with foreign leaders, including Russia. So the challenge for him will be to prove that he can put America's interests first and not just what he's done in his career, which are to go around the world, as was his job, and represent ExxonMobil's interest.
Marketplace's Mark Garrison, thank you very much.
Thank you.
If you know the name Amanda Chantal Bacon, it's likely that you've either been to one of her moon juice stores in Los Angeles or read about her on the internet. Last year, she wrote a food diary for Elle magazine, which featured things like activated cashews, adaptogens, and various powders and supplements. The internet went a little nuts mocking and imitating her. But that hasn't stopped her from becoming something of a self-help phenomenon. Bacon now has 3 stores in L.A., plus she sells her products at places like Urban Outfitters, Saks Fifth Avenue, and on Gwyneth Paltrow's lifestyle site, Goop. And she's just come out with a cookbook. Before we got started, I had to order a drink.
Let's try deep chocolate with which dust?
The spirit dust.
Okay, deep chocolate with spirit dust.
Okay, yeah.
Let's do it.
Let's do it.
We wanted to find a quiet place to talk, and so we sat down in a supply closet at the back of her store. And I asked Bacon how business is going, and with a mouthful of green juice and cacao nibs, here's what she told me.
Business is pretty great.
Why the cookbook?
So a lot of people say, why the cookbook, and what a terrible idea to do the cookbook because you've just given away all of your recipes.
True.
That was actually the point. The cookbook is really because, you know, the mission of Moon Juice isn't how can I make a whole bunch of money and retire and, like, move to Kauai and, you know, play tennis or swim with the dolphins. The whole point that I opened Moon Juice was to invite, seduce, and excite massive amounts of people into doing this. The mission has always been, let's just turn you on to this stuff. You don't have to buy it from me. You don't ever have to come to Moon Juice.
This is a business.
Yeah, and we have to keep the lights on. And I have business instincts, and I really enjoy that part of the game. But at the heart of it, I'm super passionate about bringing this and bringing it to as many people as possible.
Is this bringing it to as many people as possible if the, you know, the drink that I had cost $14?
Well, that's where I'm at today. And so I think you've really got to start somewhere. And when I look at growing a business and scaling it, one of the things that happens when scaling a business is you're actually able to bring costs down. But you got to start somewhere.
Do you think that, like, in your vision of the future, is this all cheaper?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
You did a food diary for Elle magazine.
I did. Did you read it?
I did.
Did you like it?
You got pretty eviscerated online.
Yeah.
What was that like?
I was surprised. But you know what I can say is I was having a moment of actually feeling irrelevant in the weeks leading up to it. Like, maybe somebody else could do my job. Am I even needed anymore? It seems like there's like a whole like wellness thing, and it's like the energy around it gets feels like super like overwhelming and desperate at times. And there are like wellness conventions, and everyone can make their own smoothies, and everybody has a blog about it, and like blah blah blah. And I was just like, my God, am I still doing the right thing? Am I helping, or like have I been part of a storm? And now I can go move to India with my son and study Ayurvedic medicine. And by the time I'm 40, I'll be a doctor. Like, that's where I was at. And then this thing happened, and it actually fired me back into the driver's seat. And I was like, oh, okay. There's still a conversation that needs to happen. And
even if people think you're silly?
Yeah, those are the people that I want to talk to.
What do you say to them?
The people that think I'm silly, the people that got really angry at me, like, that's the conversation I want to be having. I've been seen through a very static lens, which is still lives that are taken in my home. And this is also something that's evolved over the last 4 years. So, you know, it's like really precious quotes from like a mom blog. And, you know, my like new age Martha Stewart vibe in my home with my crystal. That is one facet of a full being. And I am a full being.
So I need you to walk me through some of the science, because I have to say I look at some of the things in here and they make tons of sense and comport with, you know, kind of common understanding of nutrition. Whole foods, whole plants, probiotics. And then there are other things where my eyebrows go up, mm-hmm. and I look at, you know, what the Mayo Clinic has to say about adaptogens, mm-hmm. and I have trouble with that. Can you walk me through how these things work?
Adaptogens?
Well, adaptogens, alkalizing, mineralization. I mean, a doctor would say it's pretty hard to change our blood pH. It, you know, hovers mm-hmm. around 7.4.
And this is where I like to say, I'm not a doctor. I never said I was a doctor.
Yeah, but you're selling stuff that says it's going to do something.
Yes, and we actually have compliant labels. So the FDA has approved all of those. So I'm saying things that I can legally say. So I'm not going to sit here and go toe-to-toe with printouts that you have from doctors. What I am going to say, though, is that I have had a profound experience. And I have several years of blood tests where I have had Western doctors tell me that I have a chronic condition and I need to take synthetic drugs for the rest of my life to survive. And I had blood work that reflected that. And I took matters into my own hands and I used plants and herbs and I worked with some other herbalists and doctors and I completely changed my blood work. And I have the tests that prove that. And I'm talking about major hormone function. I'm talking about not menstruating for years. Oh. And now I am. Hair that was falling out, that is no longer falling out. Different brain chemistry, different hormone panels. So I'm not a doctor, but I've had that experience and I stand with thousands of other people that have had that experience. And I'm actually not looking to like change FDA policy and convince people that want to be skeptics. You know, I have a company and I'm just putting it out there, but I'm also not aggressively trying to go after the naysayers. and go to war with someone who doesn't want to believe. I do like being in their consciousness, though.
Yeah.
I think it's healthy. I think it's healthy when people don't believe. And then, you know, there's like some funny parody of me that they come across. And like, again, they kind of have to think about plant-based nutrition and they have to think about adaptogens and they have to think about their diet. Like, I don't mind that, but...
So you're okay with that kind of point of controversy being, I guess, a point of entry for other people?
Yeah. Yeah. And that was really one of the things when I saw that was like, oh, okay. I feel like I just got a little more engaged in my job again on why I should be here.
Are there business people who you look at and say, that's someone I want to be like? That is a model or a person that is inspiring to me.
I was with Arianna Huffington last week, and she's incredible. One of the things that really struck me about her was her grace and her presence. And as she's running this entire team, and I was at the Thrive headquarters, and like it's all happening, and I know how much is going on for that woman, but she was able to really collect herself and look in my eyes and be 100% present the time that we spent together. And then she's up and running. And I saw her bring that to her own team. I got to experience it and many others that were there. So that was inspirational.
You know, no doubt, that there are people who are going to listen to this interview and say, okay, so we're talking to this woman who is, you know, building a wellness business, who is in a trendy neighborhood in LA, who has been the focus of, you know, beautiful photo shoots, and roll their eyes.
Mm-hmm.
What do you say to the people who roll their eyes?
I love you. I do. Hope you're listening. Hope you take it seriously. I really love you. And I get the eye rolling, and I've been there too. And like, I get it. I can roll my eyes at myself at the same time. And if I could have 3 minutes to sit with somebody who's rolling their eyes right now, like, I think we could come out of that 3 minutes on like a positive note.
Amanda Chantal Bacon, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We are entering what's known in Hollywood as award season, and part of that is fairly self-descriptive. Golden Globe and SAG Award nominations are out. Oscar nominations will come out in January. And yes, this means prestige, but it also means money. And for some films, they get saved at the box office and given a whole new life. We are joined now by Nicole Sperling, a senior writer for Entertainment Weekly. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Let's talk about award season. It feels like it has changed significantly over the past decade as a business proposition. How has it changed?
Well, it's changed in that more players have gotten into the game. I mean, Manchester by the Sea is one of the leading films in contention this year, and that movie was purchased by Amazon Studios back in January at Sundance. There are other smaller players in the mix this year, too, with A24 distributing both Moonlight and 20th Century Women. If you go down the list and look at what movies are kind of in contention, it's more smaller movies made by more nimble, more indie players than the big studios.
If you made one of those smaller movies, let's take Moonlight, for example, which had sort of a limited distribution, does being nominated give it a second box office life?
Oh, yes, it definitely does. And I think one of the reasons why you see so many prestige pictures coming out at the end of the year in a very crowded marketplace is because distributors are counting on the boost from award nominations to kind of give them that extra revenue. For Moonlight, it's already made $10 million, which for this tiny little theater that was shot in 30 days for a very small amount of money, that's a lot of money already. They've kind of come down in their theater count. They had hit 449 theaters, and I think they're down a little lower than that. I don't know whether they will go back up. My guess is that they will start adding new theaters into the mix, especially around the holidays, so that people who've been hearing suddenly about this film, who never knew it existed before, but it received extra publicity because of the award nominations, will try to get into the theaters to see it.
How does streaming fit into all of this? I mean, do some of these films, maybe ones that have been out for a while, do they get a second life on streaming services?
Well, they all will get second lives on streaming services. It's just a matter of how quickly they will get there. I mean, the majority of the big studio films still abide by the 3 to 4 month windows, which theater owners have desperately tried to protect over the years, because their biggest fear is that if you can watch the same movie at home that's in the theater, you won't be going to the theater, you won't be buying the popcorn, et cetera, et cetera. Their revenues will go down, movie theaters will go away. Now, that's a fear we can all have. We all like to see movies in movie theaters, but there are, you know, there are some films that are small that you could watch at home. You don't need to get a babysitter. It would make sense, right? So the big studios kind of have to abide by these rules more closely than the smaller indies. For a movie like Manchester that is owned by Amazon Studios, it's been released first into the theaters by Roadside Attractions, which is their partner. And they had to do that because the movie's not eligible for Academy consideration unless it's released first in the theater. So they have to do that. My guess is that it will hit the streaming services, their service specifically, obviously much faster, because that's where they make all their money.
Right. You know, when we think about sort of past award seasons, I mean, I'm thinking back to when I was a teenager and it was like the big epics, and that's what got awards, you know, things with big names, big budgets. Does that hold true anymore? It just seems like there's so many different ways to make a movie now.
You know, it still holds true depending on the movie. I mean, last year we saw The Revenant and we saw Leo DiCaprio walk away with a big Oscar for his big epic part in this crazy film that took a gazillion dollars to make and took tons of, you know, resources to get there. This year feels a lot smaller. It feels like the bigger studio movies. You have Silence, which is Martin Scorsese's 28-year in the making epic. It made AFI's list, but it did not get onto the Golden Globes and it did not get into SAG. So whether or not that sees a resurgence at the Academy when they announce their nominations in January remains to be seen. But that's one of the biggies. The other big one is Sully. That's Warner Brothers. That is the Clint Eastwood movie starring Tom Hanks. I mean, you can't get much bigger than that. And that is in the conversation, but it has yet to nab any of the nominations that people were expecting. If we go with what we're seeing so far, we have a much smaller race in terms of smaller films. It doesn't mean they're any less quality. In fact, I think there's tremendous films out this year, but you have movies like La La Land, which is still poised to dominate at this moment in time the Oscars, and that's a movie that was made by Lionsgate for a relatively small budget. I mean, it's got big stars and it feels like a big sweeping musical, but it's definitely a lot more indie than we're used to seeing.
Are there threads that you have seen when you kind of look at the slate of buzzy and already nominated movies that tie them together, or is it all over the map?
You know, I think it's kind of all over the map. We've got a lot of different... We have movies that were generating heat since January. We have ones that were kind of... We were all excited and waiting for to see if he could pull it off with La La Land and Damien Chazelle. It's his follow-up to... Mm-hmm. Whiplash, and that was kind of this indie darling that came out 2 years ago. And every year there's the movies that we think are going to be really great and they look really great on paper and then they never kind of pan out once people see them. So, you know, making movies is hard. It's a hard business every time they do it. And no one ever sets out to make a bad movie. So, you know, everyone's hoping for it to come out as good as they expected.
Can I put you on the spot? Can I ask you if you have a favorite?
I do. Well, I have a few favorites, but I have to say the one that I'm a sucker for, and it's just a bolt of joy and love, is La La Land. I mean, that movie, I've seen it twice now, and it gets me every time. It gets better the more you see it. I can't wait to watch it again. And I've heard from other journalists who see movies all year round who've already seen it twice. I mean, that doesn't happen. We never see movies twice. We don't have time. And we're like seeking this out to go again and again.
Nicole Sperling, senior writer for Entertainment Weekly, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Some of you might be spending this weekend doing some last-minute holiday shopping. And while it is totally the thought that counts, the present can count too. Last year, we asked people about their worst holiday gifts, gotten or given, and the results were so fun, we decided to do it again this year. gifts that sound bananas to gifts that are literally bananas. Enjoy.
I'd like to think it would be a magic kit, like a box of magic stuff.
Socks for my chair.
The bottle opener or can opener that you can put on a wall. Never used it. It was a joke.
The worst present I've ever received was a bunch of bananas as a joke because I don't like bananas.
I don't think I've ever really gotten a present that I considered bad, but I mean, this like useless presents that I get that I probably won't use, you know what I mean? I got like this weird box container thing that's really nice for my auntie one year, but I feel like that's like a gift you'd give to someone who like collects potpourri and they put it on their like their centerpiece or something like that, because I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do with this.
I've gotten some pretty bad sweaters from family members, like just horrendous sweaters that you would never want to wear out in public. The ones that go in the back of the closet.
I have never received a bad present.
No, I have never received a bad present, and most likely it's because I always tell people what I want or give them a few suggestions, so they usually pick one of my suggestions, so I'm always happy.
A present is a present. It's made to be given to people for happiness and gratitude.
What is the worst gift you have ever received? You can let us know on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. It is time for the Marketplace quiz, and that is when we ask people in the spotlight to answer questions about work and money, to share stories about their careers, and the lessons they've learned along the way. Producer Haley Hirschman has this week's guest.
Hi, this is Jade Chang. I'm the author of The Wangs Versus the World. Fill in the blank. Money can't buy you happiness, but it can buy you...
Oh, you know, I think that is something that only people who were born with a lot of money and who are sure that they're going to also die with a lot of money, that's something that only those people think. Because I think that for anyone else in the world, yeah, money can buy you happiness. It's not that, like, one material item is going to buy you happiness. It's that... You know, when you go from making, let's say, like $35,000 a year to like over $60,000 a year, the amount of relief and freedom, you know, that you get in that is, it looks a lot like happiness to me.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's all the little things of, okay, for example, today when I came to this radio station, you know, you pull into one of those office parking lots and you kind of hope the people are going to validate your parking. But let's say 10 years ago, if I had seen the prices, you know, it's like, what, $3.25 to park for 15 minutes? Mm-hmm. I probably would have tried really hard to find street parking just in case you didn't. And now I feel like, all right, if they don't validate, maybe I'll be out $15, but I can handle that.
I promise that we'll validate your parking.
I figured you would. But you know, I do think that those things make an enormous difference in your daily quality of life.
In a next life, what would your career be?
I'd say the practical answer is I'd love to be an illustrator. But if I could choose anything, if I could sing at all, like even a tiny bit, I would love to write and perform music. But honestly, if you could like come back as something different in your next life, I'd probably choose to be an otter. I mean, why not?
An otter?
Yeah, they're so resourceful and cute.
Right, so we have illustrator, singer, and otter.
Yes.
What is the hardest part about your job that nobody knows?
I think it would probably be the waiting. First of all, it takes forever to write a book. So you're waiting for yourself to finish it. Mm-hmm. And then you wait for agents to read your manuscript. Once you manage to sell the book, you wait for it to be published, which I sold this book in April of 2015, and it was published in October of 2016, which seemed like forever to me, but other people who have more experience in publishing were like, wow, that's barely any time to wait. So,
what do you do with yourself during all that
waiting?
Yeah, how do you keep yourself occupied?
A lot of naps.
What is something everyone should own no matter the cost?
So I think everyone should own a pair of shoes that they feel very, very comfortable in. And I mean both emotionally and physically comfortable in. Because to me, freedom is kind of the most important thing that you can have. And, you know, you want to be able to walk through the world easily. Mm. And a pair of shoes helps.
What advice do you wish someone had given you before you started your career?
Honestly, the advice that would be the most helpful right now is think of answers to questions like this beforehand. Like, the question of which writers have influenced your writing.
Mm.
Every time someone asks me that, I'm like, hold on, let me think. You know, it's like when someone asks you your favorite color when you're an adult, you just kind of think, I don't know. There's all the colors serve different purposes, and I love them all.
Jade Chang's book, The Wangs Versus the World, is out now. This past week, Bill Gates said that he's creating a billion-dollar clean energy fund to invest in tech that can create energy and store it in a low-carbon way. And fighting climate change often centers around those big, new technologies for energy. So on this week's Codebreaker podcast, host Ben Johnson looks at technology and asks that question I mentioned earlier. Can it save us?
Even though technology got us into this pickle, it can get us out. A big, new tech solution might do it. What if I told you that a big, old solution might do it? One that held a lot of promise, but got abandoned. It's called a molten salt reactor, and it uses a chemical element called thorium. It's like the red-headed stepsister of uranium, which was chosen over thorium decades ago and used by America because it served our needs for both regular nuclear power and geopolitical power in the form of nuclear weapons. Dave Mosier has been looking at molten salt reactors. He's a science and tech correspondent at Business Insider.
So this is a story about energy and a totally different way of doing energy than we've done it for the past 60 years, 70
years. 60 years, yeah.
And it starts with like a forgotten book on a bookshelf.
That's right.
What happened here?
So a guy named Kirk Sorensen, who is a NASA engineer, he was asked to figure out how to power a human colony on another planet or moon. And he looked high and low with his colleagues in Huntsville, Alabama at Marshall Space Flight Center, and they were kind of stumped.
This is like the exact kind of theoretical question that you imagine NASA engineers like
this standing,
is like
around,
standing around talking about.
In a doorway.
Yeah.
Talking about.
Yeah.
And so Kirk looks over on the bookshelf of his colleague and sees a book called Fluid Fuel Reactors. And in that book, it described this very detailed, very extensive experiment done in the Cold War through the 60s up until about 1971 about a reactor that doesn't use solid fuel like our reactors today, but uses a molten salt fluid fuel that carries around the radioactive material inside of it. And that's where the reaction happens, not in a bar in some reactor core, but in a fluid.
What does molten salt look like? Does it exist? Are we?
I've seen it on YouTube.
Does it look delicious?
It looks.
Could I get put it on steak? What's?
If you put it on your steak, it'd probably explode because it's hundreds and hundreds of degrees.
Okay.
To melt salt, like even table salt, you have to heat it up to excruciating temperatures. You definitely wouldn't want to gaze upon this type of salt because it's made of the stuff that, as one scientist told me, is carcinogenic. But if you can keep it contained, it's great stuff. It can dissolve your radioactive fuel, make the reaction more efficient, use more of it up than a solid fuel reactor. So Kirk is really passionate about the promise of this technology. This is how he feels about it.
Every time I run my lawnmower, I think, well, we'll probably be using fossil fuels for things like this for a long time. I do think, though, that it has the potential to replace nearly all large-scale energy generation from fossil fuel. It's reliable. It's clean. It basically does everything fossil fuel does today, and then it does a whole bunch of things it doesn't do today, like makes energy without emitting carbon. So I think it has the potential to be the true replacement for fossil fuel.
So if you pulled all the thorium out of the crust, you could power a human civilization of about 7 billion people at today's standards for 30 billion years.
That's long enough for me. So if it's so great, where's my thorium reactor? Can I get one?
Well, maybe. Here's Kirk's answer to that.
Well, for the longest time, I thought that good ideas always got developed. But in my career, which has been mostly spent in technology development, I've learned that the opposite is actually true. Most of the time, good ideas languish. And only through dedicated and commitment and committed effort are you able to see a new technology brought to fruition. The problem of the thorium reactor is not that the technology was poor. It's that at different times along the course of its development, starting in about 1944 to the present, there were times when the defenders just kind of went to zero.
It's these kind of engineering challenges that really stand in the way. That's the real roadblock here. It's not the science. The science is easy. It's all those niggling little details that are going to get in the way of this technology. And the money that you need to get through all of those details and see how stuff works in real life, not just on paper.
So this isn't a completely new idea. It's been in the works for a while. What has changed? Deep sigh.
This is, there's so many answers to this question. That's why I sighed. It's like all of them want to come out, but I don't know which one to pick first.
Yeah.
One, the climate. We are expanding and expanding our use of fossil fuels. We have to find alternatives, or we are facing some serious problems in the future. Another is that we know that the commercial nuclear reactors we have today aren't the best design. We know there are better designs. We just have to make them. We can make designs that you can walk away from and they will not melt down. They will not release radioactive materials. You can't do that with today's reactors. You know, the reason we're looking into this today is because we need it. We know we need it. We know it's a better idea. It's one of many better ideas. So we have to figure out if we can do it, if it works.
Dave Mosier is a science and technology correspondent for Business Insider. Dave, thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having me.
One of the ways we know the climate is changing is big data. Sensors all over the world gathering information and crunching that information with new computing power. For a story about that, we'll hear from Marketplace producer Catherine Girardeau.
The Scripps Institution of Oceanography sits just above a classic Southern California beach. You know, sand, surf, waving palm trees. So it's no surprise that the open concrete breezeway of the Vaughan Hall Science Building has a rack full of surfboards, sleek wooden longboards, fiberglass shortboards in neon green and hot pink. Researcher Tyler Cyrenak chooses his ride.
It doesn't matter what kind of board you ride, as long as you can put the fin on it, you can collect data.
But you probably get better data if your board stays mostly in the water, right?
Well, you want the fin to stay in the water. But if your surfboard's not in the water, you're doing something wrong, I think.
Tyler is both a surfer and a scientist, and he's testing out a new product, the Smart Fin, a surfboard fin which collects data on the ocean. It's loaded with sensors to measure things like salinity, pH, and ocean temperature. The Smart Fin is made of white fiberglass with a gentle curve like a dolphin's dorsal fin and fits onto a surfboard where a regular fin would go. It turns out that surfboards may be one of the best ways to gather ocean data in the surf zone.
There's waves breaking everywhere. There's lots of sand moving. So you can imagine putting a traditional sensor out there, it can get covered in sand. You might not ever find it again.
Tyler says the data collected here could help us understand how climate change will affect the coast. And that's crucial to Dr. Andrew Stern, the guy who came up with the SmartFin concept.
My dream is that SmartFin could help us predict and prepare for what climate change is bringing.
The retired neurologist founded an environmental nonprofit, the Lost Bird Project, to start new conversations about climate change. He came up with the idea for the SmartFin through a series of chance encounters.
I spoke to an oceanographer by chance, and he said, you know, you should talk to surfers. They are intimate with the oceans in an intimate physical way. And then I ran into a surfer engineer who had built a sensor to measure the flex and the performance of a surfboard. And I said, can you make a chemical sensor in a fin? He said, sure. And here we are 4 years and 30 engineers later, we have a SmartFin.
Back in Vaughan Hall, we meet up with SmartFin calibration tech, Catherine Cat Hammond. She screws a SmartFin into her wooden shortboard and waxes it up. She and Tyler turn on their fins with the swipe of a magnet.
So right now it's actually trying to find a GPS, and then it'll start blinking green, which means that the fins start recording.
They head out to the beach about 200 yards from their lab to gather some data.
You want to go surfing with
us? Yeah, I wish I could.
You don't really need lessons to go surfing.
Yeah, you don't.
So you can go be a surfing citizen scientist all in one go.
Yeah, well, these guys make it look easy. They paddle out into the turquoise green water just past the end of the Scripps Pier. Pretty soon, I see flashes of Kat's pink wetsuit and Tyler standing tall. They come back about half an hour later.
Hey, Tyler, how was it out there?
It was pretty good.
Super fun out.
It's even more fun when you're collecting data.
Absolutely.
Floating for science.
Floating for science. Tyler and Kat are part of a team of about five researchers who have been using the SmartFin since May. They're still in beta, but come January, Tyler plans to run an ocean research project with 30 SmartFins.
We're going to put the fin on the charger and download the data.
Tyler scrolls through a smartphone app with temperature charts and graphs and maps of each location. He says the beta test is already yielding some new information that wasn't available before.
And you can see these huge drops in temperature that happen about on the six-hour frequency. And what's really interesting is you actually see it in the surf zone as well, so the SmartFins are picking it up.
Tyler says SmartFin has all the elements of a successful citizen science project. Making data collection easy and cheap was key to SmartFin founder Andrew Stern.
What is unique about the technology is it's tiny, so it fits in a surfboard. Most ocean sensing equipment is gigantic and very expensive. A SmartFin costs $200.
But he says you won't be able to go out and buy one at a surf shop. He's planning to pay for the fins through private donations and research grants and distribute them for free, but only to members of the Surfrider Foundation, an ocean protection network. Why did you make that decision? Wouldn't it seem that making this as widely available as possible would gather even more and better data?
It is very important to me that SmartFin always be presented in the context of environmental awareness.
Surfers have a built-in incentive to research climate change. The sport they love requires healthy oceans and coasts. Sea level rise, ocean warming, and acidification could wipe out some of the world's best surfing destinations. So these surfer scientists are pretty determined to find a balance between catching waves and ocean data and spending time on dry land in their labs, trying to figure out what it all means before it's too late.
That story from Marketplace producer Catherine Girardeau. And you can download full episodes of Codebreaker wherever you get your podcasts.
And that's our show for this week. Don't forget to visit us at marketplace.org, our Facebook page, or on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Eliza Mills and Haley Hirschman. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Bill Lance is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Sotara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer. Deborah Clark is our general manager. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and thanks for listening. We'll be right back. This is APM.